This is a production of Cornell University.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to our, first meeting in back in Day Hall. Everyone wasn't at the last meeting, so it's good to see most everyone here today. Gemma couldn't be with us. She, I don't know if people know, but she had a knee surgery, so she's recuperating. It is 12:16. Any late additions to the agenda for today? Great. So the first thing that we're going to do is we have Marin. I always want to say Marin. Marin and Marnie here to talk with us about the staff engagement survey. So we'll let them hop right in.
Okay. I brought for you, we brought an assortment of papers. So the first one is sort of an outline of, so we're here to give you a status update on the employee survey, which is something that you asked for, and the president then told us to do.
And we appreciate it immensely.
So we are on track to launch an employee survey this fall. And actually, why don't I go ahead and send around another piece of paper?
Yes.
Which doesn't seem like it. Oh, there's the other stack of it. It doesn't seem like enough paper. We can pass that around. We were notified in March by way of an email from David Horton that he was going to ask us to start work on an employee survey. This was something that we had sort of begun a couple years ago and then abandoned, so we sort of picked up the ball again where we had gotten it at that point in time. Where we had gotten at that point in time is we collected a large amount of surveys from other institutions. So just let me back up a minute and say, what is institutional research? We do a lot of data reporting about the university in general, but one of the things that we do is surveys. And we do surveys of students on a regular schedule. We do surveys of, now we've started doing surveys of the faculty on a regular schedule. That is every 5 years. We do a lot of surveys with students. And we do the surveys that we do consortially with other institutions. So folks from offices like our office at some of our peer institutions, we work with them to arrive at survey instruments that are similar and so on so that we can exchange data. When we started work with the employee survey, this is not a thing that has been done consortially in the past, but a number of peer institutions have done an employee survey in recent history and so on. So we began this process by collecting those instruments from other institutions and taking a look at those.
So will we be sharing data with them from this?
Probably not, but...
just as examples of how our institutions, other academic institutions, have approached the notion of asking employees about the work.
Right. And let me just say that when we started this with the faculty in 2004 for an administration in 2005, we took the same steps in that case. Lots of institutions had done surveys of faculty. We took a look at those. We were inundated and overwhelmed by the hundreds of things you could ask faculty and, in this case, staff. And our course in this case with respect to the staff has been the same that we charted with the faculty, which was very rewarding and helpful. We gathered all this information, and then we had a series of focus groups in 2004 with faculty, and this spring, I guess, with staff. And having those conversations makes the process of going back to those survey instruments and identifying the relevant questions just so, it's such a revelation, because there's so many questions out there that seem good, but when you, after having focus groups, and we had 5 focus groups with staff in informing this process, you just have a much better sense of what it is that are the salient issues on our campus and how people are talking about them, the language that they use and so on. So in 2005, there were not consortial surveys about faculty. At this point, they're not ones that I know about for staff, but as a result of our experience, we began the process of creating a consortial things. So I don't know that that will be the process that happens this time, but it's certainly not impossible that other universities have similar issues and concerns and therefore would be similarly interested in taking this path.
Right. And in fact, we'll share a draft of the survey instrument with you, and so our counterparts at MIT are working on an employee survey. So they've asked to see, what are you asking your employees? You know, so who knows? Maybe down the road you would be doing the same kind of, it's always an anonymous exchange, but just as a way of seeing how things stack up here compared to other places.
So how did you choose your focus groups?
Mm-hmm. We had 5 focus groups, and are they described in here? Yes. On the second page, we looked at different occupational categories, large occupational categories, and essentially did random sample within those groups. But just to have a sense of how different kinds of staff and different kinds of positions talked about their work experience. So it's by no means meant to represent the experiences of everyone across campus, but it was an attempt to, sort of look at commonalities and how are people discussing these things and so on.
And also just because, as you can certainly appreciate, the diversity of work experience here and the kinds of things people do, so trying to craft a set of questions that will make sense means you have to find the right level of generality to talk at, and terms that people can interpret within their own context. So the focus groups, with people doing very different things and also at different levels, different bands and stuff, was really helpful with that. Mm-hmm.
So where we are now is we have arrived at a draft instrument, and we'll pass that out in a little bit. This is a draft instrument that has been shared with various groups, including the president's senior staff here in this room, and circulated a little bit, but we're not circulating it widely. Mark this one confidential, in part because we don't want everyone to have an impression of the survey before it opens. But the stage that we're in now is that we have a draft of the survey. The survey's been programmed into a website, and we're now going through it in a one-on-one setting with a small group of randomly selected people doing pre-testing. It's essentially sitting side by side while someone takes the survey and then listening to them talk about how they understand the questions. Do they understand the questions? Like, for example, if we say senior administration, what do you think that means? Or so on. Or are there any questions that are ambiguous and so on? So we're going through that pre-testing process with employees in this one-on-one manner right now. The goal is to have an administration schedule, as I've passed out in that flow chart there, with a survey that would launch near the end of October. And it would launch it would be preceded by an email from David Skorton saying that he's asked our office to do this survey. And then the next day, our office would send out the actual survey link. It's a fairly complex survey administration because, this survey instrument, which you'll see, is actually small and fairly simple, in part because we have to speak to such a wide diversity of folks across the campus. But the administration is complex in part for the same reasons. There are people who will not take it online. There are people who would not take it on paper, and we're trying to do our best to accommodate both, which makes it a complex and more expensive kind of administration than we would otherwise be looking at. Certainly in student and faculty, it's all web administration. Shall we take a look at the instrument?
Yeah, sure.
I don't have one.
Let's keep one for that.
Okay.
So part of our goal with coming up with actual survey questions, well, one goal was that we really wanted it to be a short survey. Staff is going to be told in their communication from the president, certainly, that they are to be able to do it on staff time. But we also know, so that's one argument for keeping things short. The other thing is we also know that the longer surveys get, the less people want to do them. That's very clear, certainly with students, and everybody's busy anyway. So, you know, we wanted to try to arrive at an instrument that hopefully shouldn't take more than 10 minutes to complete. And that's part of what our pre-testing will involve as well, having people just simply go through the survey and kind of time it, you know. Obviously, that's an estimate, you know, depending how long you think about anything, or if the very end of the survey is inviting any open-ended comments you may wish to make about anything that either was asked or wasn't asked on the survey. So, you know, depending on how much time someone wants to use for that. But so that was one sort of time constraint that we kept in mind. The other thing was that we've got sort of loosely speaking, you know, general sections here where the first page of questions is people talking more or less about the characteristics of their job itself in terms of not specifically what they do, but, you know, how hard they're working and do they have enough time or do they have the right training or the right equipment or tools, that sort of thing. The page two questions are more asking, we're using the term loosely, career development here, but that's asking about things like performance review and also opportunities for promotion, that kind of thing, and professional development or training opportunities. Respect and fairness were issues that certainly bubbled up a great deal in our focus group discussions, you know, with staff members, with employees, which is probably not surprising. So we've asked a number of questions related to feelings of being treated with respect or fairness. And I think one thing that we tried to capture in the instrument and what we're certainly testing out with pre-testers to see how clear it is, we got the message, certainly we got it from, we met with Tanya and with Leslie earlier on in the process. We also heard it, I think, elsewhere, that it's important to give people the opportunity to talk about interactions and the quality of those or communications between them and the person to whom they directly report, and a sort of more senior band of how, or holistic band of how Cornell operates, because you may believe Cornell's a wonderful place, but my department sucks or something, you know. So we posed many questions, kind of several of them twice, asking once about your supervisor and then asking otherwise about senior administration or about Cornell as a whole. Other chunks of things that we're asking about, there's page four questions, asking more specifically about that sort of band of senior administration. And questions more globally about the direction of the university, you know, that kind of thing. How do you feel about those things? A few questions also there specifically referencing change at the university and what have the changes over the past couple of years been like for you or within your own work unit or department. And lastly, we wind up by asking questions, just a few questions about life outside of Cornell. So other things that might impinge on what it's like for you to be working here at Cornell, whether those are external responsibilities or healthcare issues or about the ability to balance your work and your out-of-work responsibilities or satisfaction with benefit programs. And then just a few questions about more personal demographics. Questions, so gender and sexual orientation and race and ethnicity. Oh, and I'm sorry, we've now gone down to one closed-ended question. Open-ended question, pardon me.
Is this a politically correct term?
It is. Well, actually, this is the wording suggested to us by the director of the LGBT Center.
Can I ask what the term was you were saying?
Queer.
On what page? The last page.
7.
That can't be derived as derogatory?
I think it can be used in a derogatory fashion.
I would.
But it's a separate category?
There's no reason to have that.
I know.
The section above that addresses, you know what I mean, that issue.
Yeah, I can. I mean, you could have the conversation with the director. I mean, there is a new school of thought that embraced the word. I am definitely not in that school of thought, and I'm with David. I would, yep. If I had a real say on it, I would definitely say, nope, nix it. I'm sorry if there's a movement to try to change a word's definition, but it just doesn't happen in society very easily. But
okay.
you know, pick your battles. I don't know.
I'm just saying, this is on the, I mean, we're happy to receive your feedback, believe me.
I don't even know what that means.
I mean, maybe you could take the feedback to the director and say, you know, we raised this question. That probably means other people are going to raise the question. They're going to wonder where
the question is. So we have used this. We've used it with students and we've used it with faculty.
Yeah.
And have not received
had no reaction.
I think it's probably more embraced in a younger, you know, in the students' realm.
Okay.
Older, you know, I would even say, you know,
I think it is
30 and up. It might be a completely different.
No, I quite agree with you, and for sure there's issues there, as you're saying. Yes, it is partly about. It does represent, you know, a different sort of movement as well. My understanding.
Some of us have to fight.
Well, anyway.
I don't know what that means.
What does sexual orientation look? I'm just wondering why it's even a question on the survey. I would find that was my first response. Like, what does that have to do with anything?
I think it has a lot to do, definitely, you know, if you're talking about fitness in terms of being climate culture. I mean, as a person who's gay, I would like to have a different part of my identity aggregated and being able to realize maybe seeing if there's any consistencies or different experiences based upon people's sexual orientation.
And in general, we track, we like to track information about diversity and diverse experiences, and this is the only mechanism we would have for understanding that at all.
Well, and I think it's also about just giving voice to, there are many different identities here, and it's been a neglected piece, certainly, of any, you know, surveying we've done in the past. The other thing to point out as well, and it'll be clear in instructions here, people can skip any questions they do not choose, they'd rather not answer, you know, and there's nothing that forces you into, I mean, you don't have to answer a question before you can go on to the next, so, you know, we'll make that very clear.
And I'd like to point out, too, to help the body here understand, is that Cornell has been a really good employer to work for being gay. Cornell offers domestic partner benefits before they had to be comfortable for their legal marriage. They offer spousal benefits. Especially coming here 8 years ago from a state that did not offer anything like that, and to have to come to Cornell. Cornell is really treats their GLBT employees very well when it comes to the benefits. So I've always asked the question of wanting to know how many people fit in this category, especially since there's a committee somewhere that is looking at the equalization of the taxation problem that gay couples have, because my benefits that benefit my partner are taxed, whereas, you know, a lot of people don't know that, and they're shocked when they hear that. And there are a lot of employers around the country, big employers usually, what they will do is they will compensate for that federal law problem by actually giving their gay employees a little bit more salary to compensate for that tax hit that they have with the benefits. So I'd really like to know that data. That might help us classify the things of, like, because when it comes to budgetary issues, it's like, well, how much is Cornell having to pay if Cornell was to have to do this little adjustment thing?
Okay.
So.
I'm glad I asked.
Yeah.
That helps a lot.
Sure.
One other thing, just changing topics a little bit, is we've talked a lot at the EA about people's sense of inclusion in the Cornell community, and I know, Curtis, you've talked a lot about inclusion and, you know, keeping people here and building that sense of community, and it'd be interesting if something could be in here about that. It seems like that's missing maybe a little.
And
how people, go ahead, maybe just.
Oh, yeah. So Linda wanted to be here.
She couldn't be here.
And so she emailed me some questions, some suggestions that I think might be nicely added. So, like, one of the questions I saw that these are dependent measure questions. If presented with a comparable outside job opportunity, I would strongly consider leaving Cornell.
We have
and
that.
That's in here.
Oh, that is in here?
Yeah.
I'm still looking at the date.
No, that's what.
And then, but I'll give these.
That would be great.
And maybe these are the ones about inclusion, and I'm still looking to do that.
Okay, sure. Beth?
I have two questions, but I'll ask one for a minute.
in the box where people can write anything, they will, of course. Mm-hmm. And assuming we get thousands of responses, which I hope we do, mm-hmm. will any of that be, what's the word when you capture the things?
Coded.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons that we have limited it from, taken it from three questions to one, because if you put three boxes, they will write in them, and actually a good chunk of them will write none. No, N-A, or whatever. So we will have one box, and we will read them, and we will do some work to code them, but it will be thousands and thousands. And so what our practice has been in the past with student surveys and all the other surveys that we've done recently is we code them in a minimal way and farm them out to the people that should read them. So Susan Murphy might get a stack. You know, another vice president might get a stack. A couple will get, whatever it is, we'll pass those on. We'll read them to the level of, we read them, categorize them, and we would remove any identifying thing. Unless somebody signs their name, and then that, I feel like you're saying,
pass it on.
Yeah, pass it on.
Well, the other question that I had was, in your flowchart, would there be any concerns with widely publicizing it? Your department will be publicizing it and following the flowchart, but for the EA or other random unit to publicize it, would it confound?
No, we want this, and we want you to. This it's actually a pretty big thing, because one of the things that came out in the focus groups that we talked about, what kind of, would you take the survey, and that's one of the reasons why we want to keep it short, because we know this anyway, but people in the focus groups are like, I wouldn't take it if it was long, there's a fair amount of, what's this survey really about? Is this so that we can figure out who to lay off next, or, who exactly is going to see the results, and so on. So we would appreciate the support and help of you guys in saying, one, this is something that you wanted and you see as a tool for benefiting employees. One form that might take is that we're going to have a website with frequently asked questions on it and answers. If we could have something from you guys, like a letter of support or something that we could point to and say, no, this is not about this. This is not, administrative streamlining again or something like that. This is and maybe recapping some of the wording that's in the resolution, or reprinting the resolution, or but we do need a large scale communication effort, and we did talk about this with the president's staff, and they're keen on this as well. That this is not intended. That this will be helpful to the university. That it's not going to be a vehicle for. Layoffs or any kind of retribution against an individual employee. And I think we need, from my point of view, we need a strong message of that goes in all directions to the employees themselves as well as to the consumers of the data, that that we need to take steps to ensure that no one is hurt by this, because there is that potential.
And Nancy Doolittle, with the paw print, we'd be really happy to put something in the paw print about this and be working for that.
We did communicate with her this week about this.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
So I'm reading confidential in the description of the confidential survey.
Right.
Is that because you will then be able to sort by college or department or that sort of thing? I know we go back and forth, you and I, about confidential versus anonymous.
Yeah.
That's another place where we just have to be really
careful
about the wording.
Yes.
So what Leslie's saying is this confidential survey, as all our surveys are that we do, are confidential. They are not anonymous. So we actually, when someone, a student or a faculty member, takes a survey of ours, they take it in a way that we know who they are when they take it. And then reminder emails go only to people who didn't respond and so on. And then we use the fact that we know who they are to merge on institutional information. So, in fact, some of the information that's on that last page is not entirely necessary, because we actually know from personnel records someone's male or female. We wanted to ask specifically how long that they've worked at Cornell, because that data is actually not as easy and great as we think it should be. Because I don't know how many of you have had errors on the how many years have you worked at Cornell thing and the employee essentials. It was way off for me, and it's off for a number of people, and I had to work to get that fixed. But so we use that information so we don't have to, I mean, we have probably 20 different questions that we would have to add on to here if we didn't have that information. It has been our experience, and even in talking with people about it one-on-one, that most people just cruise right over confidential, sounds good, you know, and don't linger on, does that mean it's not anonymous or whatever. But we take data security extremely seriously. We, you know, have super secure server situation. You know, we don't share individual level data with anyone. Data never leaves our server, et cetera, except for in the aggregate and reports.
So can I ask a question with that? Is there any university policy that any data could get out to an individual basis? Like, say, hypothetically, Susan Murphy or Mary Opperman makes their request. Is that something that you facilitate?
We would not do it, and we would not do it on the basis that we promise respondents in the invitation that we send out. We say your individual identity will never be disclosed. And so if someone were to come to us and ask us, I think we would say no, we're not going to do it. I mean, it's never happened, but we wouldn't do it because we say we're not going to do it.
Okay, but I'm just saying, is that a university-wide policy? Like, if we look in that you cannot release, or I mean, is it just like a good faith?
Yeah. No, I don't think it's a university policy officially.
But it's a requirement when you're filling out the IRB proposal. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's part of the institutional review board process that you guarantee the confidentiality of the data.
Yeah, that, I don't know. That kind of scares me.
Well, there are data stewards. I mean, and so, right. I mean, who are stewards for this?
We are.
So did you guys consider asking if someone self-identifies as disabled?
Mm-hmm. I don't think we have considered that. And,
no, because there's no other way that question that that's not asked on an application or
anywhere else
that we're gathering that information. So that might be interesting in terms of some of the other, you know, answers that people have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have
good question
wording for a question that would
sure,
work? I mean, you could send that.
That would be great.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, that's another good example of something where there's not good institutional data.
So what is your open-ended question going to say?
I think it's something like, it's not.
Please use the space below for any other comments you might like to make about your work experience at Cornell.
So it's like the third one.
It's like the third one, yeah.
Okay. Any other questions?
This is just about out of time.
So is this going to be shared with us then, Stanley?
The results? Yeah, so we have a very open history in how we share our survey results. We tend to do an institutional level summary that goes on our website. So all the student surveys, faculty surveys, and everything, we write reports and make them very public. And it would be our intention to move that same direction with this.
Right, so we could write something in the proper and point to that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There will be probably finer grain analyses that are not public. Mm-hmm. So Susan Murphy might get a report about student and academic services.
Right.
Because
I think we'd be interested in hearing about certain parts of the survey in relation to how we can serve the employees.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then so something you could probably ask Mary, because she'll probably get something more specific than for the general public.
Right. Or, no, I mean, and certainly, yes, if there are specific either questions, I mean, of course, hopefully you can all look at this, right, but some that are more relevant than others, or a particular way of looking at a particular type of comparison or something, that would be a great value, you know,
right,
to you as a group.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can certainly do that kind of more customized,
mm-hmm,
you know, analysis or, you know, do some presentation for you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other last questions? Well, if you need anything from us in between, please feel free to contact us.
Okay.
Do what we can.
Great. And did your questions come up, or did you?
Oh, great.
Thanks.
And you guys want these chairs?
Thank you.
And I think both of them are.
Well, that's fine, but we'll double check.
Keep us on track because we're really tight today. We've got Linda Falkson here from the University Ombudsman's Office. You're the Associate Ombudsman?
That's right.
And she's going to talk to us about a program that she'd like our help with.
Great. Thanks a lot, Tony. Well, I'm pleased to be here. And again, Linda Falkson in the Ombudsman Office. I am looking around and getting some smells because I know some people. Do we have just a minute to get names of everyone?
Sure.
And I think I have about half an hour.
Yep.
Hi. And while you're doing that, sorry about that.
Okay.
I have a couple of handouts, so I'll just have those go around the room so we can get the show on the road.
Go ahead, Leslie. You want to start?
Leslie Morris. I work at the hotel school.
David Brooks. I work for Architecture Arts.
Bill Elsie. I work at Baylor College.
Lavanya Sayam. I work at Baylor.
College of Engineering, Human Information Science.
Frederick Costelli, CALS Business Partnerships and Foundational Relations.
Bridget Schaffner, Campus License, Parties Group.
Amy O'Donnell, with the New Assembly Office. Tanya Grove with Theater, Film, and Dance, and folks along the back there, you want to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Natalie.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you talk.
She's my dad,
I am from the Assembly's Office.
Curtis Ferguson, School of Film Administration.
I appreciate the quite a diversity of areas at Cornell. So I'm here today because in the Ombudsman Office, we keep a list of people who can serve as employee representatives pursuant to the employee grievance procedure. So what I'd like to do is hopefully in this year help in increasing the pool of people that we have and hopefully diversifying that pool. But I always like to take the opportunity when I'm in front of any group to just make sure people are also familiar with ombudsman services and what we do and how that works. So are the pieces of paper going around? Is that
okay? We had a fork in the
Okay. That's what I sent in the email, yeah. The second page is not. So the first piece of paper has says employee assembly meeting, and then the second one is the role of the employee representative. So just again to thank you to talk about the ombudsman role. So it's a bit of a mouthful, ombudsman. And we use the word ombudsman as opposed to ombudsperson or ombuds because it's a Swedish word that is actually gender neutral. But basically what it is it's a place where students, faculty, and staff may speak confidentially about a problem or conflict and obtain guidance. So it seems really simple when I state this definition, but it's actually a sort of a pretty nuanced term and the idea behind it. So I'd like to explain it a little bit more. Basically, there's four tenets by which we operate. And the first has to do with confidentiality. And so that's why I say it's a safe place for students, faculty, and staff. So anyone who's experiencing any difficulty within the Cornell system, any community member, students, faculty, or staff, is completely free to come to our office and confidentially talk about what the problem is. So when I say confidentiality, I mean it in the way that in the counseling setting, things are confidential. So if someone talks about imminent risk to themselves or someone else, then we have an ethical duty to do something about it, and we always explain that. But beyond that, what we talk about in the office about someone's job or whatever the difficulty is remains confidential. Sometimes people want to waive confidentiality, and that certainly is possible. Sometimes whatever the presenting issue is, there's just not full information, and they think that if I or one of my colleagues, whoever they're meeting with, and there's three of us, makes a phone call to human resources or whatever to try to get more information, with their full permission, then we would certainly be happy to do that. But without an explicit waiver, everything's confidential. The second tenet is independence. So we're right next door, we're not in Day Hall, we're not a part of Central Administration, we're actually not a part of any other department. So I report to Charlie Walcott, who's the ombudsman, and he's quite intentionally, according to the guidelines for the office, he's an emeritus faculty member, so someone who feels very free to make decisions and be free from the administration and that type of thing. So we're not a part of another department, and very quietly tucked away in Stimson Hall, happens to be in an academic building, so that people feel comfortable coming into the office. Then the third tenet is informality. So again, what I actually came here to talk about really is the grievance process, which is a formal process. So when people come to see us, say again, the presenting issue happens to be a discipline, an employment kind of issue, we would talk about all the informal mechanisms to try to help someone and what might be available, from helping to coach them to talk in terms of talking to their supervisor or whoever they need to talk to. And the other kinds of informal steps that they might want to consider taking. But we're not a part of the formal mechanism, even though we would walk them through the grievance process and tell them how to go about doing it. We would be, and again, I'll get into it, but we would be also in a place to try to help them find an employee representative for that process. So everything in terms of conversations that people have within our office would be considered off the record, because all of it is informal. Then the fourth tenet is neutrality. So, as we all know, Cornell's a large place, and in many ways it's a small place. So, I've been in the ombudsman office for 3.5 years. I was in the office of the judicial administrator for 10 years before that. So I've been at Cornell a long time, and I know a lot of people. So it doesn't mean that it would be a conflict and that I wouldn't be able to maintain neutrality just because I knew someone. But if I had a stake in the outcome, if it affected, someone's partner, spouse, that kind of thing, then certainly I ought not hear the situation, and someone else in the ombudsman office should hear it. Or, for instance, if it involves a judicial matter, when students come in, I always disclose that that's the office that I used to work in, and if they want to talk to me, fine. If they don't, that kind of thing. So that's what I mean by neutrality. So any questions so far in terms of the office? So I mentioned, I jumped into what we do, but I meant to mention my colleagues. So Charlie Walcott is the ombudsman. As I mentioned, he's an emeritus faculty member from neurobiology and behavior. He has served a number of administrative roles, including dean of faculty. And I mentioned what I've done prior to being in the ombudsman office, and Adam Kleinberger, who has been with us since January, has a background in dispute resolution, has a master's degree in that area, has worked at other institutions prior to Cornell. So sometimes people wonder, well, whatever their particular issue is, would it be appropriate to come to the ombudsman office? And part of what I'm here to say just about our services, we're very open and happy to talk to someone, but even if it may seem like
a more trivial kind of situation, but yet important to them, or very, very serious, say to the point of someone facing dismissal from the university, and everything in between. And so I have kind of a listing just to give you a flavor of the kind of situations that we see, but it's in no way exhaustive. So again, employment cases, so for staff, those by and large is sort of the biggest category in terms of when we see people, and that not only is that obviously very important to people, but it also presents a pretty emotionally charged issue, and we certainly recognize that, and that again relates to the employee rep conversation that we'll have, that one wants to be very sensitive to what people are going through, if their employment is at risk or if they're having any conflict within their employment situation, whether it's dismissal, layoff, discipline, or just a general conflict with a supervisor or employee. We see faculty and academic staff, and sometimes the issues that come up are tenure, reappointment kinds of issues. And then less serious, but people, as you know, sometimes you hear about the Cornell big red tape, people are often very charged up and jazzed up about issues relating to fees and fines and wanting assistance in terms of what to do when they think that what they're faced with isn't fair. Sometimes there are ethical issues or concerns. Someone's being asked to do something and they don't think that they should be asked and not really sure what to do about it, whether there's a policy that's covered or whether just in terms of their sense of ethics, whether they should be required to, but yet they don't want to do anything to interfere with their relationship with their supervisor, whoever's asking, so we're there for those kinds of issues. And then the various, we all work with people, and so invariably conflict comes up, various interpersonal issues, and so we're a place to try to help people in that respect. So unless we have any questions about the Ombudsman Office, I'm going to then turn to the subject that I'm here for.
How many volunteers are you looking for?
Well, we have six right now, and so we're not looking to increase the pool appreciably, but a couple more, two, three more would probably be great. So that gives you some other questions. Okay, so then I'll turn to the next part of this. So the grievance policy is Human Resource Policy 6.11.4. And the purpose of that policy is to establish a procedure for the fair, orderly, and speedy resolution of disputes that sometimes arise between supervisors and staff. So that's what the policy says. The bottom line is sometimes people can grieve based on any policy violation 90% of the time, 95% of the time, or even higher based on my view. It's the discipline policy that someone's being disciplined, whether it's a warning or something more serious than that, and they want to grieve it. They feel that it's not just, and they're not really sure how to do it. And so they utilize this procedure, and basically they need to, in writing, submit their grievance within 10 days, state their reasons, sign it, and that kind of thing. So I'm not necessarily here to sort of get into exactly how the policy works, and anyone who wanted to avail themselves of their assistance for community members doesn't have to know the ins and outs of the policy. We do a yearly training. We work with Alan Mittman and Lauren Jacoby in Employee Relations to do that training, so people would have a good sense as to how the policy works and what their role is as employee rep. Really what I'm looking for are, if you, and I'm not looking to you, you're already making major contributions and offering your time quite a bit as members of the employee assembly, but what I'm thinking is, in your role, you may have an idea of various employees at Cornell who are particularly well suited, that a lot of these issues, as I mentioned, are highly emotional, very upsetting to the people who are facing discipline, which is often what the case is, and who might be grounded and want to volunteer their services, and it's not a huge time commitment. So as I say, we have a list right now of about six people. I'd like to increase it to six, to you know, eight or nine, and I basically don't ask anyone to serve more than once a year. It can take a fair amount of time for the service, so there's not an expectation that when I call an employee rep that they'll necessarily be available, but that they will be available at least sometime during the year. And would need, so the next sheet talks about the basic requirements that they would need to, you know, as you would guess, to take on this role. They'd need to be an employee in good standing, be a full or part-time employee, exempt or non-exempt. They would have to have permission from their supervisor, and generally we would communicate just that the supervisor knows that they're on our list and might be for this purpose, be able to attend our training. And then just in terms of the basic attributes, again, it's somewhat intuitive. People who have a sensitivity to the plight of others and would be, not only do they help people sort of with their grievance, but there's a grievance meeting. Sometimes people call it a hearing, but it's really more of a meeting. Sometimes someone needs to speak up on the part of the employee who's the grievant and say, oh, did you meant to talk about such and such an area? But to, you know, have the wherewithal to A, do that, but to do it in a, you know, tactful way, to obviously have good communication skills, that kind of thing, to be respectful of differences and all kinds of background, and to have sort of basic good judgment and knowledge of responsibilities of supervisors and employees. And then one of the very crucial things is, just as our work as ombudsman is confidential, anything within the grievance process would be confidential, so that employee would, you know, have to absolutely keep what happens, what their conversations are with the employee confidential, and what happens at the meeting, at the grievance meeting, confidential. So sort of what you would think of in terms of someone being good at that, what you would think of intuitively. So I think, I'm not going to get into all the details of the handout, but I think that covers the basics, but I'd love to entertain questions on any of this.
The only question I would have is if, you know, if I was talking to someone and they were interested in doing this, but they were concerned, you know, what if I get in over my head?
Mm-hmm.
So do they fall back to you? I mean, are you there to advise them? So, you know what I'm saying? If
yes,
they're not quite sure.
So we are there to help people throughout the process who are serving as the reps. And we simply can't take a formal role, but we can do anything that's of an informal nature, and advising would certainly qualify. Before they start, when they get the first phone call, and through the process.
Someone agrees to be a rep, what are the chances they'll get
an employee
or issue?
That they'll get a phone call to serve. So we generally ask them to, you know, to sign up for a year, and most of the people then have continued. We've started keeping a list just in the last few years when I started in the ombudsman office, and people have continued on the list. So I would say most people get a call during the year, but not everyone, and sometimes when they do get a call, they're unable to serve, and then that actually means that the whole year goes by. So other boards that I'm on, where we've employed volunteers, it is kind of what's hard, at least for me, with this function, because you're agreeing to be a volunteer, but you're not engaged in the process throughout the year. You're coming to the training, and you're maybe getting, you know, one or two or maybe three phone calls, but only with the expectation of serving once. So it's kind of a funny fit in terms of volunteer work. So it's a different, it's a level of commitment, because when someone does do it, it can be an involvement of many hours. The hearing can be, the meeting hearing can be an hour or two, and the preparation can be 3-4 hours, I'm told.
So you kind of assign situations to the field reps as opposed to like the staff. In fact, everybody in my given area would know that I was their representative, like, so they would come to me when they have a grievance. It doesn't really work that way.
Well, the way it works is, and what the policy says is that people can serve themselves, or they can find a rep themselves, someone, and that is actually the best practice, that someone actually knows someone, trusts them, and so on. But then we have this role that if someone needs someone, that we will help assign them a representative. So we don't send out the list of representatives, but when someone comes to see us, I already I already know that, say, one person on the list has, or two have taken cases, and so I'll tell the person who's making a grievance who the other representatives are, and either they will make the phone call or I'll make the phone call, sort of depending on what feels most comfortable. But it's not, to answer your question, it's not a list that's sort of posted on the web.
It could work the other way, where someone knew without the representative.
That they could just get in touch with you, yeah. Well, and you don't have to be a formal representative. I mean, someone could just be grieving and say, David, would you help me out? I mean, there's nothing formal about this, except that we're keeping a sort of a list just as fallback for people who don't actually know someone that they can turn to. So a lot of it is done informally, but they do know someone.
And you wouldn't do this role because you remain neutral.
Right. So you're more, as the employee rep, it's more of an advocacy position. And also the grievance meeting is a formal process. And we are, our duties have to do, or not duties, but our role is to try to help people informally, including telling them about the formal process, but we're not involved as ombudsman in the formal process. Is that all confusing?
Do people feel like their role as an employee rep is, I mean, do you get the sense that people feel like it was a good experience for them as helping someone? Or I'm just wondering what kind of feedback you get from the people who are employee reps about doing the job.
Uh-huh. The feedback that I've gotten is that it's challenging, that someone is really sort of trusting you with what's really important in their life, and they're in a very difficult place in their life, and it can sometimes be time consuming because the person understandably wants to talk about their whole job situation, not just what the actual allegation is and say their discipline, but it's very fulfilling is what I'm hearing for people, because they feel like they really have helped someone, and in fact not even someone who happens to be a friend, a community member, so that it's been quite fulfilling in that respect. And it's what I find, that I really like about my job. So.
So is this something that you would want us to, like we do in EAE News, that we would put a blurb maybe in our EAE News explaining, that we're looking for employee representatives for this process and that they should contact your office if they're interested? Or do you want to just kind of do word of mouth to people that we might know?
Well, I was thinking that at least some of you might, through word of mouth, have someone in mind. If that doesn't yield any candidates, maybe. But it's not like it's
smaller.
A job that I'm, there to sort of interview 20. So I don't want to be flooded with people, and then when we're only looking for a couple, and don't, if people are interested, want them to participate. So I would say the first step would be just sort of your ideas about that. Does that sound?
Good? That's fine. Are people comfortable with, if you know someone, putting up?
You also, I think when you first started talking about this, said that you were looking to diversify the representatives. So can you talk a little bit more about what you mean when you say diversify?
Yeah. And in fact, I'm happy to share with you, it's not confidential, who the current reps are, which I think I brought with me. That's what I'm implying. So Lee Adler, who's a senior extension associate in ILR, Jana Bugliosi is in the School of Continuing Education Summer Session. Abby Eller is also the same role, continuing ed in Summer Session. Susan Riley in Residential Programs, Janice Talbot in Gannett Health Services and as a health educator, and Linda Tompkins, and she's the Associate Director of Engineering Learning Initiative. So 1, 2, 3, 4. So 5 are female, only 1 male, so even gender diversity would be great. And there's no ethnic diversity. Everyone happens to be Caucasian. So just those are the kinds of things that have come to mind. Thanks for asking.
Would you want the assembly to just promote your services, even if you weren't looking for representatives, just
promote your services in our farm?
Oh, I'd be happy for you to do
that. Yeah. I don't want to hear about it before I say.
Is that right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been doing some outreach through new supervisors programs at Gannett, those kinds of things. But sure, that would be another way, or you know, if you wanted me to come talk again or something like that. That would be greatly appreciated.
Any other questions, Belinda?
And so you have on the handout, you have the ombudsman email, which would be fine to use, or you could just write to me directly. Appreciate your
time.
Thank you.
Okay. So next on our agenda, I'll just jump in. Report from the chair, nothing. Too much to report yet. We haven't had a meeting with Mary, but I do know that right now they're potentially looking at November 28th as the date for the president's address to staff. So really, but it's not confirmed. As I said,
that is after
the Monday after Thanksgiving. But
that
he could not. What? I think at this point, considering it's like a week before classes end, I think he can't do it any earlier. So that was the day that they're looking at. So
when did we do it last year? Was it in October?
No, we did it November 11th, I think, last year, which was a Monday as well, I think. And Monday, it seemed to work. But that's the date that they're looking at.
I think possible location.
Yeah.
You were thinking of it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I was gonna find out about that. I just got the date. I think
yet.
Or something like that. We had our first leadership breakfast that Bridget and I went to. And my gosh, that was so long ago. What did we talk? We talked essentially about how the different assemblies can work together a little bit better. And so one of the things that the university assembly has done is placed all the chairs of the different assemblies on the UA so that there'll be better information sharing. But we do have Ned, who's one of our UA reps. We also have Jim Blair, who's now the president. Executive vice president of the UA. Tim Ostrander, who was an EA member, has taken a role on the UA, and we still need to fill two more spots. One or two more spots. So if people are interested or know someone interested, you should let us know. One of the other things we talked about at the UA meeting was in the Chronicle and the Paw Print, they're going to start putting a little sidebar of things that are happening in the different assemblies. A lot of the student assembly and the GPSA will be putting what's coming up at their meetings. What we'll be doing is kind of putting a recap of what we've done at our meetings, and Leslie is going to do that, right?
Absolutely.
So there'll just be a little snippet in there of what's going on, just hopefully to raise our visibility. Anything else I'm forgetting?
No, I think that was about it.
But the leadership breakfast happens monthly, and Bridget Schaffner and I usually go, and then we have one floating seat, so we'll be asking people to join us so that you can participate at different times. That's all I have. Approval of minutes, if everyone wants to take a quick look at the minutes, if there's any changes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, great. Committee reports. We don't have any committee reports because nobody's met yet. Just very quickly, obviously we didn't have a retreat because of the flooding. And we talked to the executive committee and decided it's just going to be too hard to try and get everybody for a half a day block. So we're going to try and cover some of the things we were going to talk about at the retreat in this meeting. So that's why we had the employee engagement survey both here today. So as we go through the next couple of meetings, we'll have some kind of things.
Speaking of committee, so I did go ahead and make copies of the university assembly committees and the employee assembly committees and how many people we need to house each one and a brief description.
Pass them on.
Take them and look at them and think about what ones you want to join.
And let Bridget know.
Anybody else, and let me know.
We're having a real hard time getting people to join the committee, so like, we've got to come up with some strategies.
Yeah.
Have it down to like three people on the communication committee or something like that. So. And everybody on the EA board should be on what at least.
Yes, it states on there if you need to be an EA member. How many EA members we need and how many non-EA members we need.
And I'm going to ask if people who aren't doing a whole lot of stuff with the EA right now, if you can really step up and become more involved. Like Leslie's chairing communications, that's a big chunk. You know, Bridget and I go to quite a few meetings and things, so if other people who aren't doing much more than the twice a month meeting, if you can step up and look at some of these committees and really get involved, take some ownership, that would be really helpful.
And we really need to be moving on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, if it's an expectation that we're all on the committee, then we should all be on the committee.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's just helpful.
So maybe by the next meeting,
yeah,
everybody,
yeah,
could be signed up for the committee.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
EA members
right
need
online,
to,
right?
And EA members need to chair the EA committees. So I know Leslie's doing communications. I've taken on staff recognitions and awards. So we've got personnel. We've got education. The CARE Fund Committee is not a committee of ours anymore, so that has to come off of our list. But that's a different committee, but Gemma's on that. And Beth.
Point of clarification. Do we need to serve on one on either side or one on both? I just can't remember.
The university assembly side, I was kind of confused on that. I do know though that we do have to have a non-EA member on Codes and Judicial Committee, if I could talk, and we need to have one EA member and one non-EA member on Campus Welfare, and one EA member and one non-EA member on Campus Infrastructure. And the UA has contacted me looking for these people.
So my question
is, I have nobody to give them.
So
that wasn't exactly my question.
Right.
Okay, so this is what I'll say, just in general, just to try and get to take care of it. If everybody can email in the next week one EA committee that they're willing to either chair or serve on, and one UA committee that they're willing to chair or serve on, and then we will, Bridget and I can sit and look at them, and we'll try to distribute evenly. So if everybody can pick one from each side.
And we're emailing you.
Yep.
Also,
no, or
Bridget,
you, yeah, sorry, Bridget.
Okay. I serve on the University Benefits Committee. That's not under UA.
Right, that's a separate one.
Okay. So.
But that would be helpful, like when you write in and say, I'm serving on this committee,
right,
already, because
mm-hmm,
that may,
right,
you know, there's only a couple of committees and we have more people than committees. So if you're already serving on another committee for the EA, add that to your list so that we don't overbook you. Because we realize everyone's busy.
Do you know what the Transportation Advisory Council falls under?
That falls under Campus Infrastructure, but there's no more Transportation Advisory Committee. Yep, that's gone away, so now it's Campus Infrastructure. So if that's something that you're interested in continuing being involved in, you can put yourself, you know, say that I'm interested in that one. Does that make sense to everyone?
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So if everybody can do that end of day Monday, because we have our executive meeting on Tuesday and we can hash that all out.
Email is
BAC89.
And I also have T-shirts for anybody that orders.
She signs up for free food.
That's right. You get a free T-shirt.
Our employee assembly T-shirts.
Where are they?
There's a box right over there.
We'll get them when we're done.
We'll send them out to everybody when we're done.
Okay. care fund auction. You want to, I know you got to leave. You
wanna, I know, I want to say to do this update. Two things. One is a care fund update. We have had over 25 applications because of the flooding. The university has stepped up and is ensuring that nobody will be rejected. And so we have spent in the past week over $30,000. The university has stepped up and is helping to fund that, but on the employee giving side, I've had over $5,000 of just pure donations from people just like you to the fund, which is fantastic. We need to come like that.
Yeah, I was going to say, can we, have you been talking with Nancy?
Yes,
okay, good.
Yeah, the fund committee and the fundraising committee have a communications group with Betsy Schreier and Jennifer Loeb, and there's a whole, everything is as publicized as it can be.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's more coming out. The fund auction on the 20th is has taken a beautiful turn and is now going to be an online auction leading up to the morning of the auction, and then at the auction itself there'll be additional items that Peggy Hain as an auctioneer will auction off. And so what I'd like to do is send you the auction site, which is being built right now. So you can look at it, you can bid if you want, but it will keep growing. If you know of or think of anything that you or someone you know wants to donate, have them call me. We need about 10 or 20 more items, and we'll have just fantastic list of stuff.
Beth, are you doing any sort of like combined, like gift baskety kinds of things?
Yes.
Good, because then some people can maybe do some little pieces of things.
It's as creative as you want to be.
Okay.
Anything, you know, we need inexpensive things. So if you want to donate something that costs $10, that would be great, because there are a lot of people who can't do the big auction stuff, but can give $10-$15, no problem.
And when the auction date?
20th of October. We hope you're there.
Mm-hmm. Where are we going to be?
G10 Biotech.
And Gemma says we need volunteers.
And we will be
able to kind of block your date, your calendar for that day to help out.
Yes.
And
we have some students who are helping as well.
I do a sheet, a sign-up sheet, if you want any of us.
Talk to Gemma about that.
Okay.
She's in charge and that's the list.
Okay.
Thank you.
And I also have the list of what you guys are working on that you have secured for donations so far, if anybody wants to look at that.
That would be good.
Gemma shared that with me, and I'm helping her collect donations on the Cal side. So
we heard about those.
Thank you.
They're fantastic.
Thanks. All right. The next thing we have on our list is the continued question of a parliamentarian. And I don't know, we probably don't have much time to talk about that at this meeting, but do people have a sense either way, informally, do we need a parliamentarian? Jason, you were parliamentarian last year. Gary's not here to talk about the year before. Do we think we need one?
My point is that normally a parliamentarian tries to operate under Robert's Rules of Order for running a meeting. If your meeting gets much larger to, like, you know, county legislation type size and things, and you have to maintain strict order because the public is there as well, that's when you really want to go by parliamentary procedure to also prevent runaway meetings as well. So I don't think the size of our organization warrants that. We're a pretty calm group. We can be kept in order. So like we speculated before, if we grew to a 30-person body, maybe it would have been much different. But maybe for now, it's not needed. Maybe that might change in the future. I mean, if you wanted to continue the position as minimal use of what that, or minimalist of what that position has to do, it would just be another body on the executive committee, another voting member on the executive committee. So you can keep it for that, but then if you're talking about eliminating and streamlining things, then I don't see a big need for it right now. Because the vice chair could always consult the charter if there was a procedural issue.
Right.
Yeah, right.
David, do you have something?
I was going to say maybe we could just suspend that as opposed to like rewriting our entire charter and eliminating it that way. Someday, if we did grow to have 30 plus members, you just reinstitute the position. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that could be a question for our, if we don't have a parliamentarian, we're not obviously stopping function, so we may not need to have that position filled.
I mean, we do nothing. There's nothing that says that it can't just stay vacant.
Right.
And as long as every person at this table knows why it's vacant and nobody wants that seat at the executive committee and everyone's okay with that, then cool. But every time we introduce a new EA member to the table, we'll probably need to offer them that ability to say, well, if you want to sit at the executive table or executive committee, this is open, you know, and we could just leave it open like that and we don't have to do anything.
Okay, so we'll look to do that, keep it a vacant, open position. Do people feel comfortable with that? The other item that came up was the idea that the communications chair should be part of the executive committee. In the past, because the vice chair was the communications chair as well, that person was sitting at the table. Since we've split those two positions, the sense that we would want the communications person at the executive committee came up, and people have thought it's a good idea. I just want to see what other people think about
that.
Well, we'd have to, I think, vote on that. Well, that'd be an RE question, because technically the communications chair is separate now, so we may have to add that as a new member of the executive committee. But I just wanted to get a sense of what people thought about that.
I think it's important.
I agree.
Current communications chair, what do you think?
I don't want to go to another meeting, but I think it would probably be helpful for information sharing.
So I'll look to write something up for our next meeting, just some wording, and we'll plan to vote on that if we need to. I'll ask Ari.
Well, speaking of...
Come on, parliamentarian.
Yeah, parliamentarian. The charter says if it's something that's going to be a revision to our charter, we'll have to have it proposed at the next meeting, and then you vote on it at the next meeting. But if you talk about it at the next meeting, and you're pretty much, well, this is a done deal, show of straw poll, yes, we all pass it, okay. And procedurally, at the next meeting is when you take the official vote.
Yep. Okay.
Which is, in all due fairness, because when you change the charter, all members of the body are supposed to know that a change to the charter is occurring, and that rule is specific to help protect everybody's rights as a member of a body.
I think parliamentarian.
Just very quickly, employee day. We had talked about people potentially volunteering. Last year we staffed a table, which we didn't find very beneficial, but people volunteering. But since that's like a couple days from now, I don't know what they still need. And
10 days.
Let's say the
21st.
Yeah.
9 days.
So, are people interested in volunteering to do that? It's a Saturday evening, serving food.
And we can wear new shirts.
Wear new shirts, get them dirty.
Okay.
No response. I hear it's Saturday, October 1st.
I can't do it for my
I'm going to volunteer.
Yeah.
I'm going to see if I can. I got to schedule out. And then, Leslie, you've got a minute to...
Okay, I have bullets. Day of Caring was yesterday for the United Way. Woohoo. They filled up on Hope Plaza, wherever Hope Plaza is from here. And then they took it over to Stewart Park and did food packing. And it was also the launch of the United Way campaign for this year. With the Cornell launch, will be at Employee Day. Mm-hmm. United Way is going to have their own table. They're going to have cake cutting, one cake. We were hoping to actually have instead of the dessert being a cookie at the lunch, at the meal, we were hoping on cake, but it was $2 more per person, so we're not doing that. They're looking for more communication this year about the campaign, just to get people informed so that they know what their money is going toward, and they put together nice, these are too much, but fact sheets about where the money is going, that has been parceled out throughout the year. We had talked quite a bit, well, a couple of times when Paul Streeter came in about whether we would do an automatic renewal every year, about the United, whether the United Way for Cornell employees that would be automatically renewed, and that has not, that will not happen. So every year, every employee will be asked to contribute to the campaign. And then we're keeping our ongoing relationship with women's hockey, so look for opportunities once the hockey season starts to go to games, to contribute to the United Way through your tickets, and they'll also have tables from agencies at the games, so that you can learn more about the agency.
Thank you.
Yep,
pretty good. Any last anything?
Just random thought. Instead of a parliamentarian, should we have a designated person that writes a resolution for us?
Instead of like normally, it's like whoever's idea it is, you write the resolution, or you have to find people to help you, or blah blah blah.
Finally, Ari's offered this.
Yeah, Ari's offered to write our Ari always offers to write our resolutions for us.
He has a lot of power.
All those in favor of making Ari our parliamentarian.
All right. Anything else? Thank you all for coming. Motion to adjourn?
Motion adjourn.
Second.
Okay.
Okay.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.